You know, Dad, it's funny.
What's funny?
Well, whenever we cook inside, Mom always does the cooking. But whenever we cook outside, you always do it. How come?
Well, it's sort of traditional, I guess. You know, they say a woman's place is in the home, and I suppose as long as she's in the home, she might as well be in the kitchen.
Oh. Well, that explains about Mom, but how come you always do the outside cooking?
Well, I'll tell you, son. Women do all right when they have all the modern conveniences, but us men are better at this rugged type of outdoor cooking. Sort of a throwback to caveman days. Hand me those asbestos gloves, would you, Ollie?
Kids are not defective, part 10. Gender roles and pigeonholes.
Outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you drop
so
in.
Very nice.
I'll hold your hands, they're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to
beautiful.
Worry.
What's your
and
hurt?
Father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace.
So,
roar.
Really, I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't hurry.
Maybe just a half a drink more.
Put some records on while I
the neighbors might
think. Baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this
no
drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew
your
how.
Your eyes are like starlight
to
now.
Break this spell.
I'll take your hat. Your hair looks
I
swell.
I ought to say no, no, no,
mind
sir.
If I'm moving to
at least
sir.
I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't stay.
Baby, don't hold out.
Baby, it's cold outside.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is December 20th, 2010. Happy holidays. Christmas right around the corner, along with a bunch of other festivities and celebrations. So I hope you're enjoying the season, the baking, the shopping, the wrapping of presents, the dragging of trees that clearly belong outside into your home, and all of the other wondrous traditions that this time of year brings. Also, no podcast award for School Sucks this year. That's unfortunate. We didn't win in either of the categories in which we were nominated, but that's okay. We did get nominated, and that really was helpful for the promotion of the show. I think we got quite a few new listeners, and it really boosted the downloads during the nomination and the voting process. So thank you again for all of your support, for your nominations especially, but also for your votes, and maybe we'll try again next year. But again, thank you. It really helped promote the show in a big, big way. And speaking of promotions, I cannot believe that I mentioned zombie movies in the last show and forgot to slip in a plug for our friend's upcoming film, Chartorum, that is produced by Jason Osborne, directed by John Shaw. Jason, of course, a big supporter of School Sucks Podcast for a long time. So if you are interested, certainly keep your ear to the ground. And if you're interested in helping promote that project or seeing what you can do to help Chartorum reach a wider audience, first thing I would suggest doing is checking out the website and seeing how you can get involved. I'm sure they would appreciate the help. So go check out their website. It is chartorum.com. That is chartarum.com. I think it's Chartorum is the correct pronunciation. There's a couple trailers there, some information about the film. And of course, this is Think Twice Productions. Jason and John have also been doing some work for Free Domain Radio, if you want to get a sample of their work. And today on the show, two guests, Wes Bertrand, the host of Complete Liberty Podcast, who's been on the show a number of times in the past. He is also the author of Complete Liberty, The Demise of the State, The Rise of Voluntary America. He is also the host of 2010 Podcast Award nominee Healthy Mind, Fit Body podcast, and the author of the book The Psychology of Liberty. Also today, Stephanie Murphy, the host of Pork Therapy podcast. She is also a writer for LouRockwell.com. We are going to discuss in detail a topic that Stephanie proposed: gender roles, gender stereotypes, how they are perpetuated through education, family, religion, and culture. I would certainly appreciate your feedback on this topic, since this is kind of new territory, a new exploration for us. But the show runs a little long, so we'll get right to it. Thanks for listening and take care.
So Stephanie and I started talking earlier. This was her her topic around this general question of why are there so few women involved in the Liberty Movement? And we watched a Reason TV interview with Allison Gibbs, who's the executive director of LOLA.
Mm-hmm. And LOLA is the Ladies of Liberty Alliance.
And she threw out this number as far as men to women involved in libertarianism or the Liberty Movement in general, because I guess she gathered this data mostly at political events. The ratio she came up with was 19 to 1, which sounds very, very heavy on the men's side. And if you look at, you know, what the community is in New Hampshire, it's obviously a little bit more balanced, maybe 4 to 1, 5 to 1, but definitely considerably more men than women involved in this thing. And that led to some other questions, like, are women less interested in politics than men? And is there a reason why, if that's true? What do you think, Wes?
That's funny. Less interested in politics. Well, I do know that on various dating sites, they recommend, actually, it might be Plenty of Fish, they explicitly say, do not discuss politics.
Wow.
for the men. They have like a top 10 list of things to, you know, break the ice through email and so forth. And that is one of the things. No, you know, real discussion of ideas. That's pretty much off limits. So I think there's definitely a trend like that in the culture and within the Liberty Movement. It's definitely noticeable. I would say 19 to 1 is probably pretty darn close, you know. And I'm not sure if that's taking into account the spouses and girlfriends of various men that are in the Liberty Movement too. Is it? Do you guys know?
Well, so I was hosting She Talk Live, and Allison actually called to talk to us about this. And she said that basically this was based on her experience going to a bunch of events over a couple of different years. And from what I gathered, they sounded more politically oriented. But she said she actually sat there and tallied up and counted the number of men and the number of women. And then she came up with this 19 to 1 number. So I would assume that was everyone there. So probably does include wives and girlfriends, I would assume.
Yeah, I would think so.
There's a lot of talk on Free Talk Live when, you know, people call in and they say, oh, I'm in North Carolina or I'm in Oregon or
My wife doesn't want to
yeah. move. So a lot of people are who come here have gone through, in many cases, a gradual process. I believe Mark Edge, one of the hosts of Free Talk Live, included in that the gradual process of convincing a female significant other to come to New Hampshire. So if you look at how many people are in New Hampshire, men versus women, the amount of people who opted to move here specifically to get involved in the FSP or the Liberty Movement in general might be even lower than what's actually here as far as numbers are concerned. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, sure. Like basically that there are fewer single women who moved here by themselves.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Which seems to be relatively infrequent from what I've seen, especially here in Manchester.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mentioned to you guys earlier when Sean called in, I really resonated with some of the things that she was saying about sort of the psychology that's encouraged and discouraged with girls as opposed to boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of gets into our little discussion about that woman's book, the woman that Stéphane Molyneux interviewed on his Free Domain radio show called Delusions of Gender, How Our Mind, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference by Cordelia Fine, who I'm not sure what her background is. Are you familiar with her background, Stephanie?
Yeah, I think she was actually a neuroscience researcher.
Do you know where she is?
From whence does
she hail?
I don't know which
Australia.
City.
Yeah, she had that Aussie accent, I remember.
Yeah.
So she was just basically poking holes in all the different supposed science on the differences between men and women and where those differences come from, right? And I think that what we see in the Liberty Movement is just an example, sort of magnified, of these differences, perhaps. Although I think that the women that are in the liberty movement are definitely independent-minded and willing to be critical of many things that a lot of women that sort of haven't taken the red pill, if you will, are not so inclined to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like you have to take a step out of society and the social norms in order to become a hardcore liberty lover, right?
Right. And I think this also on the topic of that book, it raises that question of nature versus nurture, how we talked about before we actually started recording that a lot of these studies about gender differences are inaccurate. And the question that she seems to be raising in her work is, are there really these, like we just said on Complete Liberty West, one gender from one planet, the other gender from another planet kind of thing? And I think you said she worked pretty hard at, taking John Gray, the author of that book, to taking a lot of his arguments and his assertions apart in her work. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. He's one of the prominent ones that forwards this notion that there are distinct gender differences. And I don't know how hardcore he is about where the genesis of those things are. He's just basically looking at, descriptively, how do men in general behave? How do women in general behave? And then how can they relate to each other so that they can actually get, some needs fulfilled and, get along in a sense, act more in harmony with each other because they understand each other's perspective, right? But that's obviously based on these collectivistic generalities about what men are like, what women are like.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that one of the things that I agree with Cordelia Fine on that she's suggesting is that by trying to put the focus on these biological differences or people playing up the idea that there is, it's more of a nature thing than a nurture thing, it is sort of, in a way, sweeping centuries and centuries of past gender inequality under the carpet and saying, oh, we're not going to deal with that, or how those things are reinforced sort of thoughtlessly generation after generation in culture, in school, in family. But maybe it is more an issue of nurture than nature. And I think that kind of starts to move us. It might have been a little unclear where we were going with all this at the beginning for the audience, but this is leading towards, a topic related to childhood and education. And the question we asked was, are women less interested in politics? I think an interesting follow-up question is, what motivates people to participate in politics or to care about politics or to argue and think about things that are political?
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, we were discussing that some of this might be a consequence of some repressed childhood trauma. I kind of want to get Wes's thoughts on this before we start.
You mean the focus, why some people are interested in politics mm-hmm. versus not? In the realm of politics per se, right, the blood sport about Republicans and Democrats and stuff and voting, there's a large percentage of the population that are interested in that,
mm-hmm.
The kind of politics about liberty and outside the box freedom stuff. That is definitely something that, people are not so interested in. I mean, they almost go out of their way to, avoid the gun in the room discussions, right?
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're talking about things that aren't really that root striking, then it's kind of okay. It's just coffee talk.
Exactly.
But when you start getting,
right.
When you start getting into the moral issues about your own autonomy and choice and how that's been throttled since you were a child, that's pretty serious stuff. And I think it takes a degree of independence for a man or a woman to really start discussing that and being interested in what sort of things in the culture that unravels when you start exploring it.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Cordelia hails from the UK originally. She got her experimental psych degree at Oxford and then got a master's in philosophy and criminology at Cambridge. But she's in Melbourne now, University of Melbourne, in the Department of Psychological Sciences. So she has familiarity for the issues and culture that result in differences in gender. But it'd be interesting to have a discussion with her about this, you know, the nature of liberty, because I think that I don't think that she's oriented towards the philosophy that we are. And I guess there's a larger issue too of like, why are some people interested in philosophy? Because politics is just a branch of philosophy. It's, as Ayn Rand outlined, the fourth branch of philosophy. It comes after ethics. So after you determine how you should treat yourself, the values and virtues, you determine how individuals should be treating each other, which is that social aspect of ethics, politics. Mm-hmm. So why are people in general interested in philosophy more than other people are? You know, why is that such a small segment? And if you look at Freedom in Radio, I mean, Stefan has been trying to reach out to everybody about philosophy, promoting philosophy, not so much politics, because that's kind of an end result, right? So it seems to me, I don't know, I haven't spent much time on his boards, but there are quite a few women on those boards, are there not?
There are. And yeah, and it is very, unfortunately, I think a lot of people, even though I feel that I present arguments that are anti-political, I think most people still just characterize that as political. And when we talk about libertarianism as a whole, the way that most people are brought into it is through politics, or through some kind of dissatisfaction with the way politics work in the country right now. So when we're talking about what motivates participation in politics, maybe participating in politics leads to realizations that leads people into the ideas, the philosophy of liberty. But right now, if you look at mainstream political participation in the United States, it seems like two groups of people fantasizing about how they want aggression used against their enemies. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So, yes, the gun in the room is a foregone conclusion. We just got to figure out who to aim it at and how not to get shot with it.
Right. We're kind of looking now at, do we have some kind of gender difference in political participation that's based on a need to act out certain repressed childhood traumas or, you know, being boxed into certain expectations? Why are, even outside of anything libertarian, even in just the standard left and right Republican and Democrats bickering at each other at family gatherings, from my experience, women want to be removed from these conversations. They don't generally want any part of that, right? So,
And I have some ideas about why that might be, because I think that girls, from the time that they're young, are always taught to be peacemakers and people pleasers, and to basically put their own needs second to the needs of others.
Mm-hmm.
And
to fit in, right? Fitting in is a big one too, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Fitting in and being the one that kind of, you know, the glue that holds everyone together, I guess, if you will. And in families, that role is huge. You know, often it's filled by mothers or, you know, matriarchs or something like that. But in order to be the people pleaser that culture tells girls to be, politics really is kind of at odds with that, right? Because if you bring it up, you know, there's this gun in the room, everybody's wrestling over to who to aim it at and who has control and who's got their finger on the trigger. It's bound to ruffle some feathers, right? It's bound to make someone upset. So even participating in that discussion is really directly at odds with filling that role of the people pleaser and the peacemaker. And so I think girls and women are taught to shy away from that, even just any participation in anything political, from a very early age.
Mm-hmm. Now, Wes, what are boys trained to do?
Well, greasy, grimy, gopher guts. They're supposed to play with those, right? Yeah, sugar and spice and everything nice for girls. And then for boys, it's what? What is that?
How's that going? Puppy tails and snails.
Snails and puppy dog
something
tails.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But
yeah, well, there is a lot more. I mean, I remember playing with army men when I was a boy.
Yeah.
And spaceships, Lego stuff and all that. I mean, there is this sort of exploratory process for the toys, but I think there's a lot of aggressive stuff that's fostered you know, and being tough and not showing your emotion so much, unless it's anger, of course, and beating the other person into submission or fighting back and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, there's parallels biologically. Men have more testosterone, right?
Yeah.
And if you look at the amount of inmates or people that are imprisoned, it's really a skewed number too. I don't know what the ratio is, but predominantly most people that are sitting in cages now are men. And I think there's about over 2 million people sitting in cages at the jail level and the prison level in the United States.
A staggering number. Most of them for victimless, you know, drug possession, things like that.
Yes, most of them, definitely. But getting in trouble with the law is much more common for men than women, isn't it?
Although you could also make that same argument for people of certain races, you know. Aren't black males?
Yeah,
black
and
males
even
50?
Within those races, it's really skewed because there's a lot more men. I think it's like 10 times the percentage of black males in prison than are represented in the population, essentially.
Yes.
But even within the race, particular race, if you want to cut people up into that collectivistic nonsense, it's by and large male. But you see, in jail.
But I think that's an important distinction to make here, where people would tend to hesitate talking in terms of black and white. And even I think we might draw some criticism. Stephanie mentioned before the show that it's a possibility we might draw some criticism for even, you know, dividing this line between the genders. But I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about Cordelia Fine, is that people shouldn't feel like they have to walk on eggshells when we're talking about differences between races. Like, for example, in this country, black people and white people, when we don't realize there is a distinction there, we run the risk of doing a disservice and ignoring the history of inequality and mistreatment and abuse that an entire race of people suffered for hundreds of years simply because they were that race. And all of how that's bled into, you know, our modern society through the 1960s right up to the present day, where we have, you know, the drug war, which is a really
racist institution,
a war on black people in the inner city for sure. And I think, you know, one of my many criticisms of a program like Affirmative Action would be that it's kind of like this way of lifting up the carpet and trying to just sweep all of this gruesome history underneath it and then act like it never happened. And I think it is important that we make these distinctions between, in a certain way, just if more from a historical sense, between man and woman and black and white, so we don't forget the injustice that we inherit, you know, or that we inherit today. It's been inflicted on certain groups of people, whether they be minorities or women, for centuries. You know what I mean, Wes?
Yeah, and I think the third way of looking at this, as opposed to either being politically correct or just trying to sweep it under the rug.
Well, sweeping it under the rug is politically correct, is what I'm saying. Like, it's taboo.
It is, except for the affirmative action folks, right, that are very vehement about racial inequalities and so forth.
But their solution is to sweep it under the rug. Like, when okay, now everybody can get equal footing in the job market. Don't worry about the past anymore. Under the carpet it goes. So even though they might want to do it, they might do that with good intentions, it ultimately is a disservice that erases a lot of really gruesome history, that provides contextual understanding of a lot of the difficulties that minorities face in this country still to this very day, certainly in the inner city, certainly in the criminal justice system, because of, like I said before, what they're inheriting from the past. So it is,
yes,
the walking on eggshells is the politically correct. When you say, oh, well, we shouldn't make distinctions. Well, unfortunately, it would be wonderful if there were no distinctions. History made them for us. And I'm not saying they're real distinctions, but they've had real consequences that we still deal with today, even though the distinctions in many ways are very arbitrary. And
yeah, they're actually completely arbitrary.
Exactly.
Because they totally miss the essential qualities of human beings, you know, the conceptual faculty, which we all have. So it doesn't matter how much melanin you have in your skin or where your genes came from. We all essentially came from Africa a few hundred thousand years ago, even less than that in some cases. But it really matters how the culture is fostered in this way of looking at people on the basis of non-essentials.
Right.
And you could say the same thing about men and women too, because what we're trying to do is strip away all the cultural conventions and the presuppositions and the, you know, preconceived notions about people with different features and look at what exactly is biologically different. Well, we know it's biologically different between men and women. What we're talking about is how they perceive themselves and how other people perceive them based on gender roles in society, which is all culturally based. It's the same way with race, you know, like why would you distinguish people based on that? If for no other reason than you're in a culture that does that. So it's really traditional in that sense. There's not much critical thinking that's going on. And even within the people of particular races, the way they look at, you know, minorities, majorities, or what have you, that is all cultural indoctrination too.
Well, even right down to, you know, ethnic groups, like being Italian versus being Irish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people, I've heard people in my family use the fact that they are Italian as like explanations for certain behavior.
Wow.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definition by non-essentials, isn't it?
It's amazing. Yeah,
but there's definitely an Italian culture, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
And there's
a
black culture. And if people buy into the aspects of that culture, they end up behaving in certain ways and thinking in certain ways and looking at other people in certain ways. So again, it's about thinking critically and stripping away all of the cultural conventions and seeing our fundamental humanness. Right?
Yeah, because just like in the larger American culture, all of that is perpetuated by when the next generation drinks the poison that the older generation gives to them, basically, and, you know, and says, these are our values. These are the values that you accept being born into this thing of ours, pretty much.
Yes, just like a parent will buy the blue clothing for the little boy and the pink clothing for the little girl and give the little girl a doll set to play with and the little boy gets some Tonka trucks. Mm-hmm. That's all part of the culture, right?
Because that's what the parents have always seen and experienced and they think that's what they're supposed to do. That's the way it is.
Well, you know, girls are nurturing and they're designed to be domestic, Stephanie. And men are supposed
really?
To be
tough.
Really?
I don't feel very domestic.
Well, you're just an outlier.
Yeah, maybe that's why I'm in the liberty movement, right? Because I reject
there
those
you go. Norms. So the liberty movement definitely attracts outliers, I would say, in many respects, right?
Yeah, and that's very interesting because, okay, so this gets back to what we were discussing before. We said that girls are taught to be peacemakers, people pleasers, etc., subjugate their own needs. Boys, on the other hand, are taught to be aggressive, to not have emotions unless it's anger, to have no fear, to hide pain, and all of that. And it gets back to what we were discussing about the question of what motivates people to participate in politics. And we said, well, maybe this is some childhood trauma that's going on here. Brett said in his last podcast that aggression and acquiescence are what cause all of the problems in society. Right, Brett?
Yeah. Energy that it keeps going into trying to cut things off at the past, trying to deal with the new problem as that problem comes up, continues to miss the point that the aggression and acquiescence that are part of our training as children and adolescents is at the root of all of these things. And another quote that I used in the show was Winston Churchill said about the Nazis, who had a very similar school system. It's like these people are either at your throat or at your feet, mm-hmm. and there's nothing in between.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obey or attack. And
that really gets to the root of what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Is that this training that boys go through, the emphasis on aggression, that really kind of, if you really want to simplify things and boil it down, the training that boys get represents the aggression, and the training that girls get represents the acquiescence.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And why is that? Why are girls encouraged to acquiesce and boys encouraged to be aggressive.
Mm. Well, I think if we start looking at the way some of this stuff is reinforced, we could possibly get a historical context. I know we covered these distractions that we deal with primarily through adolescence, where for girls, and the teacher that I talked to on my show, Rich, a while back, pointed this out. And I think at the time I was a little nervous about the distinction, but he was certainly right. And then when I thought about, you know, my own observations as a teacher at the high school level, you know, for girls at that age, there is a lot of encouragement being put towards outward appearance. Everything is about how do you look? How much do you weigh? Or do you have the right clothes? Do you have the right hair? And it is, school is very much that kind of fashion show. For boys, it's very focused on sports. For the boys that don't play sports, they go to the first-person shooters. Like
the video games.
Yeah, Medal of Honor. I mean, I don't know too many of them. I know there's like first-person shooter games now where you can fight in the Iraq War, which is pretty gross. But even all of the distractions go that way of, you know, reinforcing the aggression on the one side and the acquiescence. Because outward appearance is all about pleasing other people. Yeah.
Exactly. And
fitting in, right?
Right, and fitting in. And as we were discussing before the show, too, a lot of the enforcement of both of these things not only comes from culture, but it's really kind of the slave on slave horizontal enforcement of memes that Stefan discusses so often. It's the other kids, you know, it's the boys that are all you know, talking about who beat each other in which video game and who's the toughest one at which sport, and the girls that are talking about, you know, who has the best hair and makeup and, you know, who's the best looking.
And I'll be in high schools. I'll walk through, and several times in the last year or so, I've walked through the hallways of high schools. Boys go to school today in sweatpants, right? I see kids who don't have laces in their shoes.
You don't see boys getting up at 4 a.m. to blow dry
to
their hair.
To do their hair, no.
And I knew so many girls in high school who did that.
Right,
so
exactly.
Many.
Exactly.
Or waxing their eyebrows. How many men do that, actually?
Yeah. Brett does.
I'll give him a snip once in a while sometimes. Yeah.
Maybe plucking. Do you do the wax?
I wouldn't know. I don't put wax on my body on purpose.
Then you'd have to yell out, Kelly Clarkson!
No, but it's funny. It's a joke because it's absurd to think that a man would do something like that, whereas women do it all the time.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
That's why people find it funny.
But there was a time when, culturally speaking, men sort of dressed up and wore wigs and high heels and stuff, right? The Elizabethan age, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Victorian age? Not sure. But yeah, the men were supposed to be more peacockish.
Right. And the women were supposed to be, what, plump and round, right? Rubenesque. Was that the same time
barefoot
period?
Pregnant? Yeah,
that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So cultures do change, right?
Ooh,
it's just, it's amazing how they just kind of like, there's this cultural breeze that blows back and forth. And
but how much of that, if we go back to the Elizabethan age, maybe like people in the audience are familiar with the Stanley Kubrick movie Barry Lyndon, which is, I think, takes place sometime during the 19th century in England. And of course, we can see the pictures of the founding fathers of the United States with their powdered wigs and their stockings and their daintiness. But was that an upper class thing? Because they were mobilizing people, you know, these 15-year-old farm boys to fight for their cause. They weren't putting makeups on them and making sure their stockings were taut. You know, they were being trained to be warriors, right? It wasn't about peacocking up for them. So I wonder how specific that style of dress and that attention to appearance was to class as well.
Might have been.
Because that's still true today. I mean, look at a movie like, obviously, it's kind of, you know, hyperbolic and it's certainly an exaggeration, but we'll go from Barry Lyndon to a movie like American Psycho.
I live in the American Gardens building on West 81st Street, on the 11th floor. My name is Patrick Bateman. I'm 27 years old. I believe in taking care of myself, in a balanced diet, in a rigorous exercise routine. In the morning, if my face is a little puffy, I'll put on an ice pack while doing my stomach crunches. I can do 1,000 now. After I remove the ice pack, I use a deep pore cleanser lotion. In the shower, I use a water-activated gel cleanser. Then a honey almond body scrub. And on the face, an exfoliating gel scrub. Then I apply an herb mint facial mask, which I leave on for 10 minutes while I prepare the rest of my routine. I always use an aftershave lotion with little or no alcohol, because alcohol dries your face out and makes you look older. Then moisturizer, then an anti-aging eye balm, followed by a final moisturizing protective lotion. There is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction. But there is no real me, only an entity, something illusory. And though I can hide my cold gaze, and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there.
So that very much might be a class thing. Or you know, when other problems are solved, like, okay, I know where food is coming from, then we can start worrying about, like, moisturizers and stuff.
Yes. Although, if you think of the Redcoats back in the Revolutionary times, they would dress up pretty prim and proper and get in their sort of regimented lines and then get blown to bits by the guys behind the trees. So I guess it really is about fitting in over practicality in many respects in our culture.
Mm-hmm. So we had three spheres here of influence when it came to, how do we want to say, when it came to reinforcing these things?
I would say that before we said that, you know, this aggression on the part of boys and acquiescence on the part of girls is put on them by culture, basically. And what do we mean when we say culture? Well, I think the things that reinforce these memes in kids are family, religion, and schools, government schools. Actually, I think it's probably private schools too.
Absolutely.
Any kind of school.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So those would be the three things that make up culture in this, in what we're saying. So should we start with family?
Yeah.
So I think family, you know, obviously that's the first thing that a child is exposed to in their life. Kids pick up on everything. I mean, everything. From what they see their parents doing to their siblings to things that they see on TV or just around in their home, right? And so family is the first opportunity for kids to learn gender roles. And often what they learn is, you know, basically the first thing is that boys and girls are treated differently, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that sort of sets up the gender roles, right? The differences between men and women. And they also observe probably how they see their parents interacting. And we were just talking about how young most kids are exposed to TV nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Wes, you were saying that perhaps these ideas about boys kind of gravitating towards trucks and Legos and army men and building stuff, and girls gravitating towards dolls comes from things that they're seeing on TV or whatever in broader culture and just repeating, right? Mirroring.
Yeah, modeling, right?
Modeling, that's right.
They see things that will allow them to fit in and be accepted. And I guess this ties directly into the self-esteem principles as articulated by Nathaniel Brandon, because if we base our self-esteem, our own confidence and worth as human beings in how well we fit in or don't fit in with other people, then we're really going with the cultural flow, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
And we're running the risk of losing our true identity and just playing roles.
Right, and then there's also this desire to basically please the parents, right? Or the parents may not love us as much or may abandon us or may ignore us.
Yeah. I mean, think of all the little boys that didn't want to play with the Tonka trucks or army men. And, you know, we've all heard stories about that, that a boy didn't want to do that and ended up becoming homosexual, you know, as they relate their stories about how they were different from the other boys. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it happens with boys that don't become homosexual. I mean, I don't think that is the, you know, unifying thing there. I think it's about the whole fitting in versus not, and what is acceptable and what isn't, and what is tolerated by parents and what isn't. Mm-hmm. You know, so we don't even know how our culture would look if there were more of an understanding of this stuff and more acceptance of a whole range of different things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It actually reminds me of a story from a friend of mine who said, you know, his family was really poor growing up and he had two sisters. And so when he came along, he would play with his sister's toys, which were kind of, you know, secondhand. And he was playing with ponies and dolls and stuff. And that was like so egregious that a boy would be playing with these dolls and ponies and stuff that, you know, he just got relentlessly teased for it and everyone would comment about it and his teachers and stuff. But, you know, his family couldn't really afford to buy him other toys. So the teasing kind of stuck.
Yeah, he wasn't fitting in, right?
Yeah, not fitting in.
Just because of what people's expectations are and how ingrained that is. That is a... Again, we get into that sort of helicopter parenting and that hand-holding of, like, trying to steer a child to a certain place. I played sports when I was growing up. You know, I played hockey. I played baseball. There were parents who would go to these games that the whole experience had nothing to do with their child, you know, having a good time playing some sport. It really seemed to be, like, about them. Like, I saw parents fight in the stands at hockey games.
With other parents.
With other parents.
Yeah.
Insane.
As it should be, Brett. I mean, seriously, you can't just be a fan. You got to be a participant, too.
So, well, it seems like, you know, that a lot of parents have these unfulfilled, or a lot of fathers maybe have these unfulfilled high school sports ambitions that come hell or high water, Junior is going to live out for him. And I feel like I saw a lot of that with my... I never felt that pressure from my father, but I saw a lot of it with... Hockey was particularly bad for that, I think.
Mm.
Intense pressures to live up to expectations, basically. I was just looking on the Wikipedia page under gender roles. Interesting... Talcott Parsons' view. You heard of him?
No.
No.
Working in the United States, Talcott Parsons developed a model of the nuclear family in 1955. At that place and time, the nuclear family was the prevalent family structure. It compared a strictly traditional view of gender roles from an industrial age American perspective to a more liberal view. The Parsons model was used to contrast and illustrate extreme positions on gender roles. Model A describes total separation of male and female roles, while Model B describes the complete dissolution between gender roles. So under Model A, the total role segregation in education, it's gender specific, boy schools and girl schools, right? High professional qualification is important only for men. Under profession, the workplace is not the primary area of women. Career and professional advancement is deemed unimportant for women. Housework. Housekeeping and childcare are the primary functions of the woman. Participation of the man in these functions is only partially wanted. Decision-making. In case of conflict, the man has the last say.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in choosing the place to live, choice of school for children, buying decisions.
And that kind of
childcare and
that kind of gets back to the lesson that women learn about subjugating their own needs, you know, allowing someone else to be the decision-maker.
Sure. And I know in religious families that's, you know, it goes God, man, woman, right?
Right.
Down the pecking order.
Yeah,
and that's where we're
codified.
Going. That's where we're headed next, too.
Yeah.
The last category here, child care and education. Woman takes care of the largest part of these functions. She educates children and cares for them in every way. And then on the Model B side, the other extreme, total integration of roles, co-educational schools, same content of classes for boys and girls. Obviously, they're taking the whole idea, the paradigm of education as the given, right? Same qualification for men and women. For women, the career is just as important for men, therefore equal professional opportunities for men and women are necessary. All housework is done by both parties to the marriage in equal shares. Neither partner dominates. Solutions do not always follow the principle of finding a concerted decision. Status quo is maintained if disagreement occurs. Men and women share these functions equally, the childcare and education functions. Mm. So that's interesting. I think that our culture in general is more oriented towards Model B now, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so, especially as people get, you know, as you look at younger and younger people.
Mm-hmm.
It's becoming...
At least people are paying lip service to it, right? This is the politically correct one.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Yeah, I think obviously we still see plenty of the first type you described, right? Like that.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And obviously I think the second grows, is like the first type's gradually becoming more enlightened, from what I heard you say. What was it before that, right? Where... If we take that step back, we take just like, you know, a little bit more enlightenment out of that and go further back into the past. Like, what were the, this was the 1950s, what were the expectations for women in 1915?
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people don't realize how revolutionary, and in, for many more traditional Luddite types, how terrifying the decade, the 1920s, was, where this self-expression for women in the United States, in American culture, that was absolutely unheard of for many people.
You're talking like short hair, dancing.
What were they called? Flappers?
Flappers, yeah.
Flappers, yeah.
Short skirts.
Women smoking.
Women smoking. Mm-hmm. And drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
Yep.
Outrage. Outrage.
Until, was it Freud's uncle?
Bernays.
Or nephew? Bernays, Albert Bernays.
Edward Bernays was Freud's Edward. Nephew who actually began a campaign on behalf of the tobacco industry to get women to smoke, because it was considered very, very taboo for women to smoke prior to the 1920s.
And after his handiwork, then it became marvelous.
Dog. Well, he made it cool and patriotic because he called them freedom torches. Cigarettes. Oh. Freedom torches.
Is that like freedom fries?
Yeah. Like freedom fries.
Sure. Interesting.
But so I think we covered family pretty well.
Sure.
Right? You want to go on to another reinforcing mechanism, which is religion?
Mm-hmm.
A major one.
You can start that if you want.
Sure. Yeah. So the biggest thing that I see, the biggest meme that I see religion enforcing, is this weird thing about female sexuality in particular. And it's both at the same time that, you know, women have this thing that's so special about them. And of course, that's their sexuality, that, you know, it's so special and so sacred and so important that it becomes like the most important thing about them, right? But at the same time, they're supposed to feel guilty about it. And, you know, it goes back to the original sin. I mean, I remember learning when I was a kid in my, you know, religious school that childbirth was painful because Eve did a sin. And so all women were punished for the rest of time because of that. And I think that kind of sticks out at me because I thought about it when I heard that, and I was like, all women are punished, and I should be punished because I was born a certain gender because of something I never did. And, you know, I'm getting told this story that, you know, I should be punished for something that I'm not even sure even happened.
Right. And so of course, too, Wes, the woman who gave birth to the most important man who ever lived did it without ever having sex with anybody.
Right. And that's the only
Immaculate way. Conception.
Yeah, that's the only way it could be. It could be immaculate, right? Because sex is that's gross. You know, that's dirty. It's wrong. But it's also this great gift that you're supposed to give to your husband and your husband alone.
Yeah, you wonder when this sort of meme came about. Was it mostly from monotheistic religions? Because it wouldn't seem that the hunter-gatherer society would have this sort of hang-up.
Well, it seems to predate monotheism. I think the Greeks had their Pandora's box story, and which is sort of a predecessor to the Adam and Eve story, where a woman unwittingly releases all evil into the world. Even in mythology and religion, that women have been villainized before, certainly in Christianity and Islam, I think to a lesser extent from what I understand in Judaism. I could be wrong.
No, Judaism, actually, so I was raised Jewish.
Okay.
And that's where I heard the Eve story about, you know.
Strike that.
That's
okay.
Well, I mean, no, I think there may be something to that, that, you know, there might be more of the guilt about sexuality in other religions, especially some of the Christian, you know, and Catholicism in particular is a very guilty religion, guilt-ridden religion. But those themes are there in all religions, basically. So I definitely don't think it's unique to some.
Looking at the nature of human sexuality, right, the fact that it is one of the most pleasurable aspects of being human, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, humans, it seems, other than bonobo chimps, we're the only organism that actually sets aside lots of recreational time for sex.
Mm-hmm.
Right? For most other organisms, I guess it's just purely biological, reproductive function. So the fact that we derive so much pleasure from sexuality sets up this dynamic where, okay, what happens when that pleasure is not not allowed or not encouraged or denied? And how do you deal with that? I mean, if you look at like the Taliban in Afghanistan, they're notorious for having these mores against sexuality and having women, you know, just cover themselves completely except for their eyes showing, right? Wearing their burqas and so forth.
Right, because women are to be regarded as these evil temptresses that, you know, are go walking around distracting everybody with their hair or their lips or whatever.
Yeah, and that at the same time, they're to be a source of pleasure in the bedroom,
right?
Behind closed doors, basically.
Exactly.
So there's a sort of love-hate relationship with the sexual process in that religion, or that sort of aspect of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Wasabi, I think it is, right?
Oh, I'm not familiar.
Is that the one?
As far as I know, wasabi is something that you put on sushi.
Oh, wait a second. You're right. It's actually called Wahhabism.
Oh, okay.
Wahhabism. I don't know what. I must have had sushi on the brain. But yeah, it's an interesting thing how just culturally sexuality is viewed in these really dysfunctional, skewed ways. And then all the guilt and the shame and, you know, even aggression that happens as a consequence of that, you know, like gets back to ancient Greece again, right? The face that launched 1,000 ships.
Right.
And Helen of Troy. So wars have even been fought over this aspect of women sexuality, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back even further, too. If you think about it, deep, way, way back when in our ancestry, human beings usually lived in groups of, I've heard numbers between 80 and 120 at the most.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many possible, if we think about male and female attitudes towards sex, where it does seem to be that men are encouraged culturally, maybe not explicitly, but there's plenty of cultural accolades for a man who has a lot of sexual partners, but that same thing for a woman is considered
bad.
Not okay, right? Now, if we think about that group mentality, one idea that I heard presented is because there used to be time. I mean, this was even the case relatively recently. Like a couple hundred years ago, most people didn't go more than 20 or 30 miles away from the spot they were born in their entire life. So there was a limited amount of people that they would be able to have as partners. But if we go all the way back to,
prehistory?
Yeah, paleo. Then we would have maybe more a female desire to be selective versus a male desire to spread a seed as much as possible with the possibility of procreating. Hmm. What are the thoughts there?
Well, I was just thinking of the difference in the time it takes for a male to orgasm versus a female. There's a pretty good disparity there. And I think that contributes to this whole spreading the seed thing and having harems and all that being bestowed upon the male rather than the female, you know? But imagine if that were switched. Imagine if females could orgasm much quicker than men. Would you see the same sort of behaviors happening in women that we see in men and culturally?
I don't know. I mean, how does that jive with the fact that, you know, usually men can only have one orgasm where women can have many?
Yeah, yeah. But I would think historically, men didn't really care about women having orgasms so much.
I agree.
You know? So obviously, yeah, if you're firing on all cylinders and your man is really in tune with your needs, that's a definite bonus. Brett, we should have sex changes because of that alone. But given this disparity in the gender roles and so forth, and the domination and acquiescence and so forth, I would guess that those needs aren't fulfilled in women by and large throughout history.
Yeah, along with many other needs. And really, like, getting back to what we were discussing before about this kind of stifling of sexuality, especially in women, I mean, human beings have universal needs, and, you know, sexual expression is one of them. This is the concept of nonviolent communication that we've all been discussing, you know, on each other's shows, on our own shows for the past couple of weeks. And really, you know, it's kind of soul crushing to do this to people's sexuality from the time that they're so young, to, you know, to associate it with guilt and just negative feelings, and to tell them that it should be suppressed and it's something that's dirty and bad. So I think that really does a number on a lot of women as they're growing up. And another thing that we discussed, Wes, that you brought up was this Wahhabism with the, you know, women should be wearing burqas and, you know, just their eyes peeking out. When you said that, I immediately thought of a memory that happened to me in government school, which is the next and final aspect of culture that sort of puts these things on women. Mm. And the story was that it was basically almost the last day of school. The school was about to let out for the summer. It was really hot. It was like beastly hot and humid out. And the classrooms, you know, didn't have any air conditioning. And they'd open these little vents, but it didn't really do much. So it was really hot in the classrooms. And so a lot of the girls came to school wearing tank tops. And I think I was one of those girls, and I was wearing a tank top, and as were most of my friends. Well, there was a teacher that pulled us aside and said, "You girls, you really can't wear those tank tops. You can, you know, if you're really hot, you can wear a sleeveless shirt. But the tank tops with the thin straps, those really have to go. You really can't be wearing those." And we were all like,
"It's turning me on too much, girls."
Well, she didn't say that, but she said, we said basically, "Well, why? It's really hot. You know, we want to be comfortable." And she said, "Well, you know, the boys really get too distracted when you wear those.
Turning the boys on too much." Yeah.
Yeah. So really, I'm supposed to be responsible for someone else being distracted. I thought they were in control of whether they got distracted or not by something as simple as a shoulder or an arm. I mean, that
impression. Now, had the boys reached puberty at that point?
Yeah, this was probably, I was probably about 13 or 14 years old at this point.
Sure.
So,
well, that's a definite biological concern, right? Because their testosterone levels are pretty high. But I agree that they should be able to control their behavior. Unfortunately, they're in a really artificial environment, aren't they? The educational system. So
right.
Oftentimes that's more about you know, social networking and getting your sexual needs met than it is actually learning things.
And right. Their behavior and their volition, we shouldn't even call it volition, but their behavior, their decision making is on autopilot through that process because no one's giving them any trust in making their own decisions.
And it would be self-fulfilling prophecy, wouldn't it? They get more of what they fear, in a sense, or assume in human beings. I mean, seriously, if their wills were respected, and it'd be interesting to do a sort of a study about this, looking at a Sudbury school with puberty-aged girls and boys versus one of these coercive institutions that you're speaking of, mm-hmm. which predominate our culture, mm-hmm. and see the differences in how girls and boys interact. Because when you really suppress all those creative aspects in a human being, what's left, right, but carnal pleasures mm-hmm. and focusing on just those immediate gratification things, right?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. a good point.
Absolutely. So it seemed that, school was really another critical thing in enforcing these, reinforcing these memes. I guess enforcing was kind of a Freudian slip in that instance, because in some cases they really were enforced, like this tank top policy that was, you know, sort of telling these, you know, girls, including me and my friends, that we're responsible for, someone else's distraction or whatever.
These memes shall be reinforced and enforced.
Right. But Wes, did you remember there's a nonviolent communication audiobook where Marshall Rosenberg, who's the author, is talking about a story where he's hiding in this classroom after school, like an hour and a half after school is over, because he's scared because there are some boys outside that are waiting to beat him up because they know he's Jewish. And a teacher finds him hiding in this classroom, and she says, "Well, what are you doing in here? You have to get out." And he said, "I'm scared." And then he tells her what's going on. And she replies, "Well, boys don't get scared," and she throws him out, presumably to get beat up. So I think school really, teachers are basically a form of childcare, right, for a lot of parents. Mm. Government schools essentially serve as daycare for older kids. And the kids are spending so much time around teachers and classmates and administrators and all that, that, you know, they can really have a very significant role in how kids view a lot of things. And so experiences like this, like, boys don't get scared and don't wear that because the boys will get distracted. You know, those really help to form kids' opinions of things like gender roles when they grow up as adults. Those things stick.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, there's the kind of horizontal enforcement, as we talked about before, where, you know, teenage and younger girls, now younger and younger, actually, are placing so much emphasis on outward appearance as something that's really to be valued and is to be spent a lot of time maintaining and changing and always doing new things with the hair and the nails and all that and the clothes. And and for boys, it's, you know, it's the sports, the video games, that kind of thing. The aggressive music, maybe in some cases.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, just about every sport that we're encouraged, I was talking to somebody about this last night, just about every sport that we're encouraged to play throughout our entire lives, everything from football to ping pong is basically replicating the battlefield. You know, my side, your side, offense, defense, I'm guarding this, you're trying to get to there.
Don't forget our team, your team.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the most collectivism.
It was one of the reasons why I was giving people my little speech about baseball and how it's a unique game because the defense has the ball and the only time that you can make anything really good happen to contribute towards your team winning, you're doing it by yourself. It's not really a team sport in the sense where of other team sports, because everything you have to do is individual in the game. But anyway, every other sport that we play is basically just one side lines up, like the British, like the Redcoats. You get a uniform, you're on this side, we're on that side, you're trying to get here, we're trying to stop you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's basketball, hockey, football, most sports work that way. So that's what we grow up with. And certainly there's team sports for girls too, but I think that if you look at, certainly through my experience in high school and working with high schools and talking with kids who, most of the kids I tutor participate in sports, schools take, you know, boys basketball, the football team, those, that's what they take seriously. Like, they have female sports clubs and teams, but it's really football that these schools take seriously. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really
the same experience.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, in a lot of cases, I hate to say it, but it seems like in a lot of cases, the girls' sports are kind of like an afterthought for these schools. And
or they're mandated by law, so they have to have, you know,
right,
Title
IX,
right?
And in our culture as a whole, too. I mean, like, if you look at professional sports, you know, they have the WNBA. It wasn't popular. People didn't want to watch that. You know, I think that that's the product of all of this reinforcement of, you know, these roles.
Yeah, so much of what we see in our culture is not based on that authentic connection with self so much as it is, like you say, these roles that people play. And instead of doing all those things, people could sit down with a book like No Contest, The Case Against Competition by psychologist Alfie Kohn, which is trying to counteract these stereotypes and cultural sort of patterns, right? He says in this book, contrary to the myths with which we have been raised, Kohn shows that competition is not an inevitable part of human nature. It does not motivate us to do our best. In fact, the reason our workplaces and schools are in trouble is that they value competitiveness instead of excellence. Rather than building character, competition sabotages self-esteem and ruins relationships. It even warps recreation by turning the playing field into a battlefield. No Contest makes a powerful case that healthy competition is a contradiction in terms, because any win-lose arrangement is undesirable. We will have to restructure our institutions for the benefits of ourselves, our children, and our society. So it's more about cooperation and thinking independently than it is trying to dominate someone else. And I think there's a lot of quests for sort of finding self-worth in being able to dominate others or to beat others, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Second place isn't acceptable. And everybody has a place, right? So, yeah, it's terribly unfortunate. So it's really about, no matter what it is, if it's parenting or schools or religion, it's about challenging the conventional notions and being an independent person that thinks and judges on your own rather than according to, you know, your sex organs.
Right. Yeah, well said, Wes. I like that. So I don't know if we've answered the question that we originally started with, which was, what is this lack of women in the liberty movement all about?
Mm.
But it's been an attempt, and it's been a really interesting conversation. Is there anything else you guys want to add?
I was thinking of a parallel that can be drawn that I've heard and seen many people talk about, which is in the tech community, like in Silicon Valley.
Huh. Like,
where
are all the female nerds?
Predominantly men there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In that realm.
So
now, people like Leo Laporte, if you look at his Twit Cottage, he has a pretty even balance, it seems, but he's tried to nurture that. But by and large, in the programming software development community, it seems to be the sort of same disparity. And I think it again goes back to cultural encouragement and discouragement, huh?
Mm. Yeah. And I think part of our job, I guess, if you will, as people who value individualism and who see people as individuals, you know, independent of their gender or sex, is to really highlight that and to kind of move away from those gender roles, which, you know, keep this artificial division present, you know.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
And of course.
And to challenge them too. I'm sorry.
Right. And I mean, it's set up to continue, as are most of the misconceptions and errors of the past, when so much of our childhood and so much of us, just this cultural absorption that we're forced to do as children, is about not thinking and is about not asking questions at home, at church, and at school. about robbing young people of their curiosity to perpetuate all of this stuff for the, in many cases, unfortunately, the emotional convenience of the older generation. We've talked about this with spanking, right? Like, it's troubling, Wes. I think this was something we touched on in the last episode of Complete Liberty. When son says to father, after son has his first child, hey, dad, I'm not going to spank my kids, right? What are the implications of that? What is the accusation there for dad? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. As one generation grows and tries to change and learn from the mistakes that the previous generation made, how much resistance is there?
Yeah, because it's discomforting to self to realize that one has been on a track that is not so respectful of other people's needs and enriching of one's own. You know, like all this focus on sports, like you're talking about, Brett, what is that coming at the expense of? Culturally, worldwide, in a sense. Mm. I was just thinking about these differences that we see. Anytime we see differences in the culture, disparities that are based on non-essentials, at least what I deem to be non-essentials, and I guess people could argue that men and women differences aren't actually non-essentials, but I think it's from a philosophical point of view, I think they are non-essential. But whenever we see disparities, do we just take that as a given? Do we ignore it because it is non-essential? Or do we actually focus on it and say, what is it about our culture that's creating these disparities? Like, why do people see other human beings based on these characteristics rather than these more fundamental ones? You know, what is going on there?
I think
it's good to kind of like challenge those conventional perspectives, right?
I think that's what we set out to do today. And that's the way that we can learn our way out of a lot of these past errors that in many ways we still live with, and we're still, you know, by which we're still surrounded today in the 21st century. And some of these things, I was talking with somebody recently about marriage and the idea of a husband as a caretaker, right?
If you look at talk about a conventional notion, the whole institution of marriage. There you go.
Well, the concept, I just out of curiosity, I started looking into some of the terminology around marriage, and today it's an honor for most people to be chosen to be somebody's best man at a wedding,
as opposed to worst man.
Right. Well, interesting that you would say that, Wes, because the origin of this phrase actually it goes back, obviously, centuries to Scotland. When it was common practice for a bridegroom to kidnap the woman that he was going to marry, literally. And the crew of people that he would have to help him would basically be the, what do they call them? Man's wedding party? People on his
side. Groomsmen?
The groomsmen. The groomsmen would be like the assistant kidnappers. And the best man would be the best among them. That's true story.
Partners in crime.
Partners in crime. The groomsmen. So that term has survived to the present day, is along with husband, which is basically the caretaker for a woman. And, you know, even my mom has told me several times that, you know, she was basically made to feel growing up in the 1960s that it was in the 1960s. You know, this is 50 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, that it was, you know, her job to find a man that was going to take care of her. That's one generation in the past.
Yeah, the whole marriage thing is setting up a whole set of memes that are pretty inauthentic, actually. I mean, marriage can be a distraction from the actual love relationship, sort of artificially binding the relationship in ways that sort of pick up the slack for the lack of authentic communication between the people and the commitment aspects.
Especially when it's tied in with the state and it's backed by the literal gun of government.
True, true. Yeah. There's a book, if anyone's interested in it, for some humor as well as insights. It's called Marriage and How to Avoid It, The Truly Cynical Guide by Guy Thomas Blues. And he was just pointing out some of the more ridiculous aspects of this institution. Obviously, the guy's not against love and commitment, but this institution itself can kind of serve as a distraction from what is really important.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also thinking about this gender role disparity that we see in the Liberty Movement and some of the other aspects, other movements and so forth between men and women. I think that maybe this one will be the last one to fall because of the biological differences and the sexual component. You know, it gets back to when Harry met Sally, can men and women ever be friends? Because the sex thing always gets in the way. You know, that movie with Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's something that a lot of people have to wrestle with. And how does sexuality factor in these differences in how people look at each other? I was thinking of Robert Heinlein's book, Starship Troopers, that was made into a movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys have seen that movie. Have you?
I haven't.
1997?
No.
Yeah. It's very interesting. The characterization, I guess it comes from Heinlein, about this sort of androgynous characterization of men and women. It's a very militaristic movie. Except the military is dedicated to destroying the insects, these giant insects, rather than other human beings. So you can kind of root for them in the sense that they're trying to prevent their own demise from these insects. But it's really interesting, the characterization in there, how the men and women relate to each other. It's definitely on an equal footing, and they treat sex as just this joyful, matter-of-fact thing.
Hmm.
That's one of the things I noticed in that movie.
And in fact, in Heinlein's book, Time Enough for Love, the other one, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, he kind of plays around with the gender roles and marriage thing too, because in that society, they have these line marriages where, you know, one person marries another, who marries another, who marries another, and they end up with these giant families where it's like this kind of this like polyamorous family where they all raise the kids together, and then there's like, you know, this big group of people living together. And I think they started that out in this book because they were colonizing the moon, and there were much fewer women on the moon than there were men.
Mm-hmm.
So that had something to do with the style of marriage in that book.
Yeah. So does that have any implications for the Liberty Movement in New Hampshire?
Well, that's what, funny enough, we started off talking about Allison Gibbs's interview on the Reason.tv video.
Yes.
That's
19-1.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what the interviewer asked her. He said, so, you know, do you think polyandry is the solution? And she basically said, well, you know, whatever each individual decides, but I don't know. Obviously, there are some people who are not into that.
Yeah, they want more exclusivity, perhaps.
Right.
And I think that is an interesting trade-off. I've had discussions of polyamory with friends, and there's the notion of spreading yourself too thin, in a sense. Like, you only have one body, and you only have so much time, so how do you want to dedicate it?
Mm-hmm.
To one person exclusively, or to a number of people that you really respect and admire?
Mm-hmm.
So it is a set of trade-offs there.
So how can we end this off? The show. I know Brett's getting sleepy.
Oh, right? Endings.
Well, I have a, maybe since we focused on sort of a problem or something that's interesting that maybe needs to be looked at, what about solutions to this issue? And I think for men, it's important to see women that aren't in the Liberty Movement as potential mates, kindred spirits, if you will, because every human being has the same needs, as Marshall Rosenberg points out in Nonviolent Communication. So it's just a matter of discerning what needs are not being met in this other person that isn't a fan of the liberty things, you know, because these needs for autonomy and independence and choice and respect are really important to us. And they ought to be really important to other people too, right, that aren't in the Liberty Movement. So this is a more general task of convincing them, hey, these needs have not been met, and not only myself, but in you too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we use nonviolent communication and really connect with the feelings and needs of these people that aren't, you know, aware of them so much, then there's the possibility, the potential to bring them to the point where they're, yeah, I really need to get these needs met too. And I admire the fact that you are striving to do that similarly.
I think too, so much of what people have done in the past, myself included, is we look at the most distant and powerful organizations and people and we say, look at how screwed up all this is. But if we started, you know, on a one-to-one relationship level of, you know, living these virtues and then gradually showing or saying to people or introducing people to the idea, wouldn't it be nice if everybody applied these ideas consistently? Wouldn't it be nice if the whole world worked like this? And that's kind of the more the way of spreading this where we have, you know, more control, certainly over ourselves and the relationships we choose than we do over the checking boxes and the TSA and all these things off in the distance that we'd be, you know, that can only really frustrate us as we try to control them. It's kind of, like I said before, I've always felt like things are being approached in, you know, the opposite way.
Yeah, absolutely. And Wes, you know, you were talking about men, you know, reaching out to women and caring about their needs and you know, using those important approaches of nonviolent communication that are just so powerful at connecting with other human beings, no matter what mm-hmm. their gender or anything about them, their age, their anything.
Or their beliefs.
Or their beliefs, exactly. And Brett, you were talking about emphasizing the personal relationships, which are just so important. They're really the foundation of a society, especially a voluntary society, which we're all striving for. And so I think it's important also for other women to reach out to, women in the liberty movement to reach out to other people, you know, men, women, everybody, and to care about those needs, and especially for women that may have had these cultural memes put on them of, you know, subjugate your own needs, don't care about your needs, just try to be the pleaser, don't talk about politics and so forth. I think it can be very powerful to have another woman reach out to that woman whose needs have been kind of beat down and subjugated her whole life and say, hey, you know, your needs matter. They're important. And, you know, let's talk about these ideas.
Yeah, there's no need to sacrifice really important needs or any needs for that matter in order to fit in.
Absolutely.
And kind of that brings us full circle back to the family, because that's the predicament that kids are in. They feel that they need to sacrifice needs. They don't even really explicate them, but they just feel that this is the case in order to survive in the family, right? To be
right.
Accepted and not be punished.
And to get their needs for love and safety and nurturing, I guess, met.
At the expense of respect and understanding.
Exactly.
that's the problem with it. So it's really not love that is being nurtured there so much as acquiescence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So these two things, like I said in the last show, I really wanted to start trying to pay a little bit more attention and put a little bit more light into understanding the importance of this aggression and acquiescence and how that scales up to, you know, the problems that we face and the conflicts in adults in the adult world. So I think we've really fleshed this out quite a bit in the last hour and a half. And if anyone has any closing thoughts, or we can wrap up.
No, that's it. Thanks, guys. I really appreciated this conversation.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brett. And I'm sure this will come up again in the future, huh? Because this is a big, big topic.
Absolutely. This was certainly an interesting exploration. This is new territory for this show as well. We've never done anything quite like this before, so.
And I'm sure your listeners in school have lots of stories to relate about gender disparities and, you know,
right.
All the different facets there, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That'd be fascinating to hear.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Brett. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, guys. Thank you both.
But what about these two blouses? Which is more appropriate for school? Which goes with the skirt?
Fellows like to see girls dress up, but in general, only for a special occasion.
But remember that any clothes look better with good posture. Now that her clothes are selected, Sue is ready to fix her hair.
I simply must go.
Maybe it's cold outside.
The answer is no.
Maybe it's cold outside.